You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
That's right, I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. As a licensed private investigator and certified instructor in nonviolent crisis intervention, with over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field. I will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Having escorted thousands of teens to specialized schools and programs, returned hundreds of runaways, and retrieved many abducted children, I bring a unique outlook on what our kids are going through and what can be done to help them thrive. And if that doesn't work, how to survive. This show brings you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today, Dr. Chuck Redwine. Chuck is the director of New Horizons Youth Ministries with campuses in Indiana, Dominican Republic, and Canada. New Horizons has been helping at-risk youth for over 35 years, and Dr. Redwine brings an international and very experienced outlook on helping troubled teens. And now I am going to bring him up right now. Chuck, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Alan.
And where are we getting you from? Are you in Indiana now, Canada, or the Dominican Republic?
I am in Marion, Indiana.
Marion, Indiana. All right. Well, I guess to start off with, I mean, tell us a little bit about New Horizons Youth Ministries and what got you to get involved in this 35 years ago.
Well, New Horizons Youth Ministries was started in 1971. It was the vision of a pastor, Pastor Gordon Blossom, who had been in residential or state care as a young boy for 3.5 years. And he'd returned to that place, Star Commonwealth, up in Michigan, to serve there as chaplain, but also had a heart to serve the families that oftentimes he had to turn away, boys that were not state-dependent, collect boys. And so his idea was, through being a pastor, he'd taken a number of mission trips to Haiti and thought, what would it do to take kids out of this culture and take them into a foreign culture in a mission setting and let them work cross-culturally? And this idea came about. A judge actually picked up on it and gave him his first two kids when he didn't even have a program. And New Horizons was launched down in Haiti as Caribou Vista Youth Safari. And it was in 1974, though, that we were asked to leave the country by the dictator, which is a great blessing, really, because we ended up in the Dominican Republic, which has been an incredible host country for us. And it's just been a real journey to see how the Lord has provided through the time, but we still have our school there. It goes year-round in the Dominican Republic, and year-round sometimes closes in for the summer here in Marion, and we have our summer camp up in Missinaba Woods in Northern Ontario, and in the summer it's a 10-week program.
Well, I mean, what got you interested in this kind of work with young people?
Actually, Alan, I was getting my psychology degree in college, and while working on my psych degree and counseling degree, I actually worked as an ambulance attendant. I spent 4 years in ambulance and emergency work, and I started when I was 18. It was my first job out of high school. I wanted to do something different than pump gas or work in the mines down where I was from in Illinois. And in working on the ambulance, I had a couple of days where I picked up a couple of my friends. And I thought, man, if I'd have been out with them or if I'd have been around them rather than working, maybe it could have saved their lives. And it's, I just have a strong sense of mission in me. And then I transferred to university and college to finish up. And when I did, I heard about New Horizons Youth Ministries, and it was actually, I was 20 or 21 years of age when God really moved in my life through dealing with death and life and all those issues, and I really dedicated my life to full-time Christian ministry, and New Horizons was one of the first ones that I heard back from when I was a college senior. I wanted to work internationally with kids, and I wanted to work with kids that really needed some tough work, not the easy ones. And New Horizons was the first one that popped up. Gordon Blossom came and visited me himself, and so it was really out of death that I came to want to work on the side of life.
Well, and when you mentioned about your mission, it's one of the things that I believe, and that is we don't choose this work. It chooses us. So what I hear you saying is it chose you.
Yes, it did. I'm very much a people person, and I've always been involved in crisis with people, like working on the ambulance or working in the church, and I've always seemed to be drawn into crisis with people, and I have a calming effect. I'm a very strong presence person myself, and it just seemed to be a natural fit for me to work. I went down first to work as a house father and then worked into administration, and I was 18 years as the program director at the school in the Dominican Republic, Escuela Caribe, and now I'm up here as executive director. I just took over a little over a year ago.
Well, speaking of the program in Dominican Republic, how many young people do you currently help there right now?
Well, we'll take a maximum of 50 students down there at one time, five houses of 10. Right now we're close to 30. We're a little low. It's been a difference for us since the 911 attacks. Fewer parents are wanting their kids in overseas settings, but as well as the economy, so we're running close to 30 right now.
Well, Chuck, I've got a special guest that just walked in, he remembers bringing kids out to you probably maybe 20, 25 years ago, and that's Marvin Smith. And I don't know if you heard last week's show, but Marvin was on the show. Marvin now has his own charter school, but if you remember back when he worked with West Shield, he was bringing kids to you. Marvin, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Chuck?
Hello, Marvin. I'm doing great. I do remember you. You're a big guy.
Oh, well, I mean, Marvin has been out to the program many years ago,
yes.
as I was. I've also been out recently, and I can tell everybody out there that's listening, this is an incredible program. There's a level of serenity that I felt just being on the campus, where it's located, in the mountains. The entire feel that you get there is just this nice calming effect that you have, and you see that in the kids. And one of the things that I came away from that was that there was life in their eyes. And there are times in which I visited programs, and one of the things that I see, especially more from an adjudicated type of program, is you see a lot of dead eyes.
Yeah.
You know, these kids have these dead eyes, and there's a spark in their eyes where I really feel like they're understanding it and they're getting it.
Yes, and part of that, and I think Marvin would understand it with his charter school and working with the poor, is that you have to give kids hope.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's important for children is they have to get their hope back, and the way they get their hope back is you got to get some hope going with the parents. Once the kids begin to see their parents change and see that it's not just all about them, they can get hope for their own life. But sometimes when if I have kids that the parents are just aren't making it, it's hard to get those kids going themselves. And so one of the change for environments for us is these kids that are down in the mountain setting, they're up on 30-plus acres of land looking down over the valley, and they see other people around them that are in worse shape than them. And they go out and they minister and they serve. We build homes for the poor. We do a lot of community service work. And we work hard. We believe in hard work and character building. And these kids get down there and they see, like, wow, I can make an impact. I can have a mission. Because these kids have to have a vision for their own life. They have to... Without a vision, the people will perish. And you have to get these kids that come down hopeless and broken and feeling suicidal and who cares. They have to get a hope and a vision for their life. And so they get down there and they exercise and they work hard and eat right. They naturally, their countenance is lifted. Their faces come up and it shows in their face. And that's how I have learned to read kids and people through the years, is just reading their faces.
Marvin, give us what your opinion was when you went out there.
Well... I have a couple opinions, and I think just kind of chiming in on what Chuck was saying. You're right, Chuck. When you give hope, and I remember when I was you would escort the kids, and I call it crisis intervention counseling. I would pick them up from home and bring them out to the program, and I would always, you know, the kids were always you know, wanting to point the finger. It's, I'm not at fault. I'm not at fault. And I go, you know, it's my parents. I go, okay, true, maybe true enough. I said, but the issue is, you don't have control over your parents. You can't send them to a program, but what you can do is take care of where you're at and what you're going through first. And that type of hope. And the goal was to have them transition into the program so when they hit the ground, they hit it running, and that way they could do well. I really enjoyed coming to Dominican, but I still have a beef to pick with Alan. And then maybe I can he can redeem his honors, Chuck, because when I got down there, I said, can I stay a day or extra day or something? And it was like, no, you need to come back because we got more work to do. I'm like, oh, jeez.
I remember you had a pretty quick turnaround.
Yes, and I'm like, jeez. But I guess there's still opportunity to come again and not be so quick with the turnaround. But I think it's great work because you do, and being a believer and being an ordained minister as well, you without hope we become hopeless. And like you said, the whole thing about, you know, my people perish for lack of knowledge, and where there's no vision, what happens? You know, so I think it's just good works, and then I believe too, history, the time doing it, there's proof in the pudding that there's something good happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chuck, in fact, along those lines, we did get some listener questions, which I thought was wonderful. You know, by listening to you in the press releases, we've had some questions that came in via email as well as on the blog. And one of them is, it says, what type of teens do you accept? It says, what if my son just isn't going to school? He's more passively defiant. What would you say to that parent?
Well, that's the type of kid that just refuses to go to school. That's a kid that's throwing up a bulwark against his parents and saying, can you make me? Now, if that child is not struggling with drugs or running away or drinking, then you have a child that, again, is being passive, and there's probably something else happening in the home rather than school. And when you get down to it with the parents and they begin to bring out what the real issue is, then you can help the parents address that. If it's just a school issue and he's not acting outside of the home, it's just in the home, then you just have a passive-aggressive kid that's saying something's wrong in the family, let's get to it. The type of kids we take are the passive-aggressive types. This would be the type of boy that we would take up to our Canadian program for the summer. That's really what we would do, just kind of give them a change of environment. That 10 weeks up in camp, our camp up there is a work camp. They have our own sawmill. We cut our own logs after we haul them in. We build our own buildings. It's probably the 10 best weeks we ever offer. And that kind of kid goes up there and shines and comes back and realizes I can do it and make it even if there's something wrong inside my family. Right. But our typical kids we take, I say that there's three types of kids that we take. One are adopted kids that are not bonded with the adopted family. These kids have identity issues when they hit the teen years, and they just bounce around, and it's easier to live in a group setting than it is in a family. Two are the type of kids that have just gone bump in the night. Something has happened. There has been a trauma. It could be a divorce. It could be a rape. It could be a sexual abuse. Something's happened that set their world on fire. And it's usually short term, within the last year, and they clean up really well and can get back on their feet and get going. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the kids, like the one dad I talked to this morning. He says, when this boy hit this earth, he was a strong-willed child. And now by age 13 or 14, you've got maybe a little disorder coming out, maybe obsession, maybe a little confidence disorder. Mm-hmm. Those are really our kind of kids. Typically, any adjudicated delinquents we don't take, or kids that are too court-involved, antisocial personality, we just have to look at each individual file, and if we believe we can help the kid, we'll take them.
Okay. Well, another one of the listener questions that came in, it says, why the Dominican Republic? Is it so the student... is it so the students don't have contact with any of the bad element that contributed to their problems?
It's not really the goal of the Dominican Republic was to totally radically change the environment and utilize culture shock as part of our therapy. So again, when you take a kid who is so entwined in their own materialistic life, they're so worried about the clothes they wear and the style and the image they give off, and all of a sudden that's stripped away and they go down to the Dominican Republic where none of that matters. All those social cues and the ways they interact and the stuff that they throw and the signs they give out, they don't matter down there. Dominicans don't give a rip about that stuff. All of a sudden that image is gone. They have to then stand in a new country, and typically then that stand there forces them to tie back into the community that we have there. We have a very strong community on that campus. Like you said, Alan, when you go there, there's just a sereneness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they take on the greater identity. The key of the Dominican Republic was not, as some people, critics say today, oh, you just want to avoid the U.S. authorities and all this type of stuff. I'm sorry, but back in 1971, nobody was even thinking that way. It was a cross-cultural missions approach to get kids in another culture. And we see in churches today what's happened with short-term mission trips. How many people say, wow, it changed my life.
Well,
to give a young man or a young woman an opportunity to live in another culture in a structured setting where they're safe and they're, again, it helps to build the vision in their life. It's not so much, you can always, no matter where kids go, they will find negative friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if you switch towns, move, go to different schools. It's not getting away from the negative as much as getting them to view things in the positive, getting them a new perspective on life, and that's what they can get when they go down.
Well said.
And I would say, too, Chuck, that is a key, because that new perspective, you're right, they can go anywhere. I mean, even dealing with parents sometimes, we talk about the drug abuse. I said, they're going to move them with a grandmother in another town. I said, you know what? That's not the issue. They'll find it wherever they go. It's till they change what's going on inside. And then, I look at, too, we're in a society now where it's all about, you know, like I had to say it, it's all about me. It's this entitlement. You know, MySpace and the kids and image, we're so prone to that in America. And then just to be able to change the environment that they can get outside of themselves and go, okay, and then feel good about it is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chuck, break down a little
one
bit.
Thing,
oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing that happens when our parents come down and visit is we'll say, well, how'd the parent visit go? And they said, what have you done with my child? what are you noticing? They don't ask me for anything. But back home, they're so, give me, buy me this, do that. Down here, I'm like, oh, no, Mom, Dad, let's not spend money on that. That's not important. Mm-hmm. No, let's just spend time together. Oh, I don't have to do that if you don't have the money for it. There are other needs in the world. And one of the things that living down there does for our kids is it really does begin to work this whole materialism mindset, because they see people who are happy and smiling when they have so little. You go to the Dominican Republic, we have a summer program where we take kids, 10 teenagers, up into the mountains, live in a Dominican village for 10 weeks. Those kids come back changed. Because here they're like, why are these people so happy? They don't have electricity. They don't have running water. And they like us. And they like to smile. And they come around, and these kids have no toys. So, like, last summer we built a volleyball court for the kids in the community just to be able to play volleyball. And they're out there every single night playing volleyball. All that we could get kids here in the States to go out every single night and play volleyball during the summer.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what the program entails.
Well, our program is very structured. We believe that structure produces stability, and stability produces security, and security allows change. So until you get the chaos out of their life and lower their anxiety level, you're not going to get any movement. Kids do not know what it means to be at peace anymore nowadays. With all the electronic gadgets and everything, they have to return to peace. And so we have a very regimented program. We get up 6 o'clock in the morning. They have 30 minutes to hit the ground when the swallow comes in. And they start making their bed. They clean the entire bedroom. We have 45-degree angles. Our clothes are all hung in a certain order. Top and lower buttons are buttoned. Clothes are tri-folded. Socks all smile on the door. Very military-wise. Mm-hmm. But the kids, once they feel structured with that and they know how to do it, then they begin to compete with each other so you can get done faster. It's healthy competition. Then after breakfast at right at 6:30, you have 45 minutes of chores, and we clean the entire house every day. And the house father goes around and checks it, and then we have someone comes in and does house inspection. So we have a very structured program. When they come down into school, if you walk into our schools, you'll realize that they're very quiet. Kids actually study, because, again, the structure helps hold them together. And they'll go through the day on typical. We have an accredited school down there as well as here in the United States, Core 40 curriculum, Save Indiana. And we'll have group-style classes, individualized classes, and at the end of the day, we work. We work. We believe in good old-fashioned hard work. So in the Dominican Republic, we use machetes, and we chop the grass, and the kids will be out there chopping the grass. And they say, what, you put a machete in the hand of a crazy teenager? Yes, we do, because down there, a machete is a work tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something to threaten somebody with. In all the years we've used machetes, we've not had a lot of problems with that. It just doesn't happen, because it's a work tool, and the kids learn how to work. We exercise, we eat right, we get kids in shape, and we see that they, by working hard and pushing them physically, we can reduce dependency upon psychotropic meds and other medications, get them down, if necessary, to a base level, or remove them entirely. So we keep them very active, very busy, mind, physically, as well as spiritually, because we have our devotions in the morning, we have scripture memory every breakfast, and we have devotions at night, and we have chapel services during the week, as well as on Sunday.
That's phenomenal. Now, where does the responsibility of the parents come in working alongside a program like this? In other words, how do you keep the parents involved to the point that you're not sending a child back that finishes the program that then goes right back into the same old problem?
Well, what we do is we have a pretty far-reaching approach. We spend a lot of time with the parents. We'll travel the second weekend of every month. We drive to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and have a meeting that usually will last 4 to 6 hours with parents from the Michigan area. Then we'll drive to Chicago and have a second meeting. And then we'll drive back to Indiana and have one here. If we get enough parents together, like out in Colorado or Pennsylvania, we'll actually fly to the parents and meet with them as well. If we have parents that are outside that, like some of them we have from California, we'll call them on the phone. And our counseling times will last an hour to an hour and a half. We have to get past the outer shell and get down to the hard issues with the parents and get them talking about, not about their kids. We do not spend time at our meetings talking about kids. We spend time at the meetings talking about the marriage. Because if the marriage mm-hmm. isn't strong and the parents aren't working together, then these kids are not going to get their hope back. Now, sometimes you have divorce cases and different issues. You have all kinds of complications to this. But it's important that we work with the parents and get them to work with us. If not, we've got to put a lot of pressure on them because we want the kids to see that the parents are involved in their intervention and their treatment by getting help themselves.
Well, I like that. I'm going to go back to some of the listener questions so I make sure that I cover them all in this time. I have one coming in from someone. It says, I found pot in my daughter's room. It said, who should I contact first? I don't want to contact the police or get them involved. And then it says, I mean, who didn't smoke a little weed back in the day? And I got to tell everybody out there, I try really hard to read these questions exactly as they came in. In the beginning, I changed a couple of them and tried to smooth it out a little bit. And I actually had people that kind of chastised me saying, why did I change their question? So, for you out there that sent that one in, I'm telling it just like it is. So, what would you say to this person?
Well, when that type of question comes up, what is the age of the child? If you're talking about a 12-year-old and they found pot in this girl's room, it's different than you're talking about a 17-year-old.
That's true.
So it's really good to know the age. And then what are the other factors? Are they smoking? Are they drinking? Are they out at night? Because kids go through different stages and levels, and sometimes it's just simple curiosity, trying to understand it. If a kid is becoming addicted to pot, and the grades are sliding, and it begins to show up, it takes a good 6 months to clear pot out of a brain. You got to really get in there and clean it out. So it all depends upon where they are at in the process. If it's first time, and they've just found it, and it's just starting to happen, that's a good time to go to counseling or sit down. And we tell people to get out of the house if you're going to talk about this stuff. Don't do it at home, at the emotional system where mom is. Get out of the house, go to a neutral place, and sit down and talk. So the child doesn't feel the pressure of the home, because mom is the emotional CEO of the family. And the child have a hard time sometimes hearing emotionally when they're in mom's home.
Mm-hmm.
And so get them out of the house, talk to her, find out where that. Say, we found this. What are we going to do about this problem? You have a problem. I have a solution. How are you going to solve this problem?
Yeah, I agree. And actually, when I read that one, I sort of saw the question within the question, because we've had this one asked before, and that's the parent that says, well, I smoked a lot of pot, when I was a kid, and I came out okay. You go, well, there's a lot of things here. First of all, pot is different today than what it was in the 60s. In the 60s, the strength of it was maybe one-tenth of what it is now. So that's the first issue I think parents need to know. And the second one is I get parents that'll say, well, what should I tell my child that I smoked pot? And I go, well, if you're asked point blank, I think you should tell the truth. But at the same time, if it's something that you liked, I don't think you need to share that with them. If it's something that you still do, I don't think you need to share that with them. So, I mean, to tell them, I'm sure that there are stories that they have of things that didn't go right while they were doing drugs. If you're going to tell your child that you did drugs, you can tell them that, but tell them about the things that didn't go well, or that, you know, as far as drinking, that, well, yeah, except then I got sick and so on and so forth. They need to see the full side of it, not just this sort of panacea of maybe what you remember about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we got another question that came in from a listener. It says, how much should I take from my kid, and how do I best put my foot down? Even as a father, I feel like I'm losing control of my 14-year-old son.
You know, you can play the give and take, power struggle back and forth, and for some kids that works. Seems like the most important tool today is internet and cell phone. Some kids respond to that, other kids will not. They'll find other people's cell phones to use, they'll find other ways to get on the internet. So it's always just a power game. And again, for this dad with a 14-year-old, what's going on in this boy's life that he's pushing against his father? I just talked to two dads just yesterday and today. I said the same thing to him. I have one that's, the boy's 17, he's almost there, he'll be 18 next month. They're calling me up saying, you know, 18's kind of hard to work with. So what you have to do, they're afraid to tell him. And I said, I want you to take him out to a neutral place, to a restaurant, and say, son, I'm tired of finding drug paraphernalia in your house, in my house. Next time I find it, I'm calling the police, and he's almost 18.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a problem. I have a solution. But how are you going to solve this problem? Because if not, I'm going to send you away. And the boy, the dad called me on Saturday, he says, I can't believe this. And I was shocked and surprised. He says, what kind of solution is this, Dad? What kind of place is this? Can I look at the website? And he went right to the web and he says, you know, I'm pretty interested in this. I think maybe I might want to do this. Can we call them up? He goes, what in the world happened? I said, one, you treated him as an adult, man to man. Because remember, for this father, he's got to take over this son. This boy is 14. This is the time he's got to help watch this boy out toward adulthood. And he has to help the son to learn to emotionally separate out from mother. And so you got to get him outside of mom's emotional realm there in the house, and treat him man to man and talk to him straight and say, we've got a problem. Dad's taking a very business-like approach to things. And he can say, well, I can take this away, I can take that away, but, you know, I don't want to have to do that. And we can do this, son, but what can you do to keep me from doing that? You got to take a different approach, or you just go through a cycle, and if you keep doing the same cycle over and over, you're just going to keep losing.
And
kids get into power struggles. Give them a chance. I told one dad today, I said, negotiate with the kid. Take him out. They've taken away his Xbox. This boy's 13. And he said, the boy just keeps defying me. I said, you need to take him out and say, how much is this Xbox worth to you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I said, well, how many hours of school am I going to get for 1 hour of Xbox? Because he's not doing school at 13.
Mm-hmm.
You let him set the value. If he says 1 hour for 1 hour, you say, oh, forget that, man. I'm not going to give him an hour playing for an hour of school. I gave more than that. Give me a little bit more, and negotiate and play that game with him. You may be surprised at the results your son has by seeing you negotiate and work with him in that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, and obviously, you're talking about your conversations that you're having with these people. How can they get a hold of you? For those out there that have questions, how can they reach you?
They can reach me by calling 1-800-333-4009, and my extension is 114.
Okay, and can you give us the website address that they can go to check out more
information?
Go to
the web at good old www.nhym.org.
All right. We're going to take a break now, and I'm going to pull you down for just a moment, Chuck. We're going to have a break, and we're going to come back with, we still have more questions of Chuck Redwine. And if I can get this thing to come up, maybe I can't. Okay. I have to bear with me. I'm working this board here. It's saying the program cannot display the break, so... And here we go. One moment.
There's something about the way you try to look. It's getting right to me, deeper than it really should. What are you, an angel, or just looking that good? When you take your time, you are so divine. I'm not surprised, I'd like to watch you in this life.
We're back with Dr. Chuck Redwine. Chuck, we're back. Do we have you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. Now, we were talking a little bit about having the kids be more interactive and have more involvement in the questions. I think Marvin has a question along those lines.
Hey, Chuck, my question is, in the process... in doing this all the years you've been involved, do you find that when the kid is part of the process, and I think as you were sharing earlier, they're more compliant to whatever the solution is to be part of that versus this is being thrown upon them? What is your view on that?
That's exactly how we see it. And what you have to realize is that our kids typically do well with comparison and contrast. Mm-hmm. So if you give them option, put the choice back on them, sometimes they'll choose right, sometimes they'll choose wrong, but they feel like they have some empowerment in it. When it comes to discipline with our kids here at New Horizons, we say, well, you've had a problem with lying or stealing. Here are the different options. Which one do you choose? They have to choose the option or the consequence that's going to be best for what they did.
Right.
Or you just say, well, you lied, this is it. You give them an option, they have to make the choice with it, then they have to live with the pain because they're choosing it.
Exactly.
And for the kids, too, they're also very strong, especially power-oriented kids, are very strong in the area of the truth and justice. They want things to be fair. They want things to be just. And if not, they'll let you know it. Now, they don't oftentimes offer that level of justice and fairness to other people, but they demand it. So, again, when you put the decision-making process oftentimes back on them in a way that, no, it's going to be either this or this, what's your choice, then it empowers them. We know today that kids are empowered in the wrong direction. I know my rights. You can't do this. I'm going to call, and they can call it abuse or whatever they want all the time now, and they can get a listening ear, and you know, I've had parents call me up saying that the police showed up at their door ordering them to give their child their cell phone back. And I was like, you are kidding me. So kids are calling 911 because they're losing their cell phone. Well, when they get that kind of empowerment, when parents get into just a war over what's right or wrong or how they want something, they're going to lose. So they have to learn how to engage them in the process rather than just alienate their son or daughter.
Right. And I think, too, Chuck, one of the things that I, even as a parent, you know, is taking that right as I am the parent. You know, I'm not your friend down the street. And so sometimes when decisions have to get made, it's understanding, you know, we're not at equals. And ironically, my youngest daughter made a comment one day. Well, she was playing, and I was playing back with her. She goes, Dad, you know, I said something to her. She said, you know, Dad, I'll call the police on you, right? I go, oh, you will? I said, but unfortunately, when they get here, you're going to be asleep. And she goes, what do you mean, Dad? I said, because I will knock you out. And then when they come, they'll be going. I said, she's asleep right now. And she said, you wouldn't do that, Dad. I'm like, oh, would I? And she said, you wouldn't do that. I said, no, I wouldn't do that. But you wouldn't call the police either, because we would work through the issues. And I think the last thing, Chuck, for me, the question being, is one thing that I see that even at our school, the charter school, and some of the things that even when I was involved with the transport, you get this situation where I'm watching a lot of youth or the kids make decisions for the parents. And that's the hardest thing for me because, you know, I was talking to one parent, and the parent goes, I think this would be the right place for my kid. And then they turn around and say, well, what do you think? And the kid goes, I don't know. I like where I'm at, Mom. I don't want to go here. And the mom goes, well, I guess, you know. And I scratch my head going, when did Johnny know best?
That's right.
You know, that's parent decision making.
Who's making the decisions here now?
Yeah, and there is a fine line between engaging the child in it and still with parent final decision being the parent.
Right.
Like with this young boy, I'm working with his family. He's going to turn 18 next month. I said, no, you have to engage him. Well, can't we just call an escort service? I said, yeah, you can, but who's going to want to take him when he's almost 18? He has to be involved in the process. When you have a 13-year-old, you inform them of that. You're making a decision.
Right.
It's either going to be this program or that program, but if you don't change, something doesn't change at home, if Mom doesn't get happy, then guess what? I'm going to have a solution for it. And I've oftentimes sent brochures and said, just lay them around the house, and the child says, what's this from? Oh, it's a program we're looking for you this summer if you don't straighten up. So make a big emotional deal out of it. Just let the kid know that you have a focus, and you know where you're going, and if something doesn't change, you're going to get around to doing it. Because you're still engaging them rather than... So at times, because of fear of flight or things that a child may do, they have to just be surprised with an intake or an intervention and be brought to campus. Well, there are other times you want to involve them in it.
Well, and you bring up a good point about the fear of flight, and I hear that a lot from parents. And what I say is that there is nothing that should be stopping you from talking about a program. What you don't want to do is to give them a definitive, an absolute thing that says, if you don't agree to doing this, I'm going to have an escort company here on Tuesday morning at 5 a.m. to pick you up. That's where you're going to ask for a situation where they're going to run away. But to just engage in conversation with them about it so that they know how you feel and that they love you and believe that this is what's going to be best for you, that shouldn't be something that motivates them to run away. Wouldn't you agree, Chuck?
I would agree. And sometimes I'll tell parents, I say, who in your family or just outside your family does that child feel good with? They say, oh, that's easy. That's the youth pastor, or grandma, grandpa, or an uncle. I said, then why don't you get a team of four or five people in your home, and when they come home from school, sit down and say, we've got a problem. This is what we're thinking about doing. And we're here because we care about you. And oftentimes you'll find that outside family force or outside community force is there, it really gets the child to think a little bit more. And there's been times that has happened, and the kid says, wow, this is pretty serious business. I'm going to straighten up. And they straighten up, they don't even have to come to our program.
There you go. Now, so that I make sure and cover, we've only got about 7 minutes. I want to make sure I cover all the listener questions, and one of which came in that says, what does the program in the Dominican Republic cost, and what is the average length of stay?
Our time is 12 to 18 months, typically, because, again, we'll take the kids that have been having problems a little bit longer. Typically, our families, they have gone through counseling, the psychiatrist, maybe some other short-term placements. So we get the kids that really need some long-term investment. So we are a long-term residential treatment program.
Okay,
but our costs will run us up to $6,000 a month. And most of our parents, though, will not pay that amount. So we've got discount based upon the, our cost is based upon the actual income of the family. And if there's a family that has greater need, then we do have a scholarship program through New Horizons Youth Foundation that holds our scholarships. So they can apply over to the foundation for a scholarship of anywhere between $500 to $2,000 a month. So private care like this, 24 hours a day, and therapy and education is very expensive. Mm-hmm. But we have worked as a ministry to keep our costs down, and to whatever funds we raise for scholarship, we just want to give right back over to our parents. Many times, insurance companies will pick up, sometimes full cost, very rare. Typically, they will cover the cost of all the counseling, individual as well as group, so that parents can get reimbursed those funds, as well as it is a, because we are a licensed child care facility, it can be a medical write-off on the taxes. So there are some ways to help the, ease the parents through with the finances. We work with families individually on that.
Okay. Well, and when you brought up insurance companies, it reminded me of a point that I think everybody needs to know out there, parents and professionals alike, and that is the term is called conversion of benefits. And insurance companies in this day and age will play hardball with you. That means you need to play hardball with them. And the term conversion of benefits will help. And what that means is that most insurance companies, when you first ask them and you go, here's my situation, I want to send my child to, you know, pick a program, the initial thing from the insurance company is, we don't cover that. And I think that's because their actuaries, their bean counters have said, look, X amount of the people will go away if you just say, we don't cover that. Now, the reality of it is that many times, as you said, they do cover the treatment portion of it. They may not cover the schooling portion, but they cover the treatment, or they may not cover the boarding. But as you just said, you have to be proactive as the parent or the holder of that policy to go back to them and say, excuse me, I believe that you do cover a certain portion of this. And on the other hand, if you don't cover this, or I mean, if you're supposed to cover this and you continue to say that you're not going to, or not do a conversion of benefits, you could put us in a situation to where the child needs to go into a, you know, a local psychiatric facility that's going to charge about $25,000 a month instead of $5,000 or $6,000 a month. So, you know, and you can tell them, and I'm looking at my policy and I know that you cover that, but. And at this point, and let's say, for instance, and I had one where I helped the family, and I said, it's now November 1st, and your policy is a per annum, and you have a $100,000 cap per year. I said, this family, if they put their child into a local hospital, they're going to generate about $60,000 just in the next 2 months. And then it's going to turn over, and they can run up another $100,000 in the first 3 or 4 months of next year. So, in the next 6 months, do you want to spend $160,000, or do you want to sit down and reevaluate and use the term conversion of funds or conversion of benefits so that this child can go to a place where they can get help for the next year or two for far less? So, I want to make sure everybody...
Very good point.
And when everybody knows that, don't be bullied by them. And along the lines of cost and getting assistance, actually the last parent question that we have, or listener question, is, it says, I checked out your website and saw that your schools are Christian-based. Is there any chance that my Christian church would help fund my 15-year-old son to go to your school in the Dominican Republic?
Absolutely. You see that many families, you know, get support from grandparents. Their grandparents mm-hmm. can intervene. There are parents that have college funds set aside, and they think, well, they'll never make it to college unless we intervene. But oftentimes, I have one mom that is a single mom, and her church and other churches have rallied behind her. And for the time that her son has been there, she has received support from the church and through the church for almost 2 years. And it continues it even to the day. So, yeah, that's a very strong option.
All right.
Because, again, the church trying to help take care of the kids is always something to consider.
Okay. You know what? We've got about 3 minutes. I think Marvin has a question. And then while he's asking that, I want you to start thinking about. I want to ask you, I want to close the show on one of your biggest success stories.
My question, Chuck, is that looking at some of the things that we're doing with our school, and especially over in Dominican, being able to, maybe at some other time off where we get a chance to talk and see how we can create an opportunity where I could have some of our kids from a leadership standpoint maybe come over for a summer for a week or so. And because I really believe getting them out of their environment, especially some of the kids we're dealing with too, because they only see, you know, square blocks, is another way of helping create, you know, leadership with some of the kids I'm working with as well.
Well, I think that would be fine and a good option, Marvin. I actually in contact with a group that wants to be able to bring some kids up to our camp in Canada for a week. I think that's a phenomenal opportunity just to get kids out of their environment and see that there is a bigger world out there.
Well,
now, when you ask about a success story,
yes,
and I could tell you a number of them.
Well,
let me just tell you one.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to say, I know that you can, and I've even heard some from the parents, but with the amount of time, just give us your favorite.
Well, one I have is, we had a young man that was down in our Mountain View Academy, which is our summer program up in the mountains. And he's a young man whose father had been killed, and he had a hard time bouncing back from that. Well, while up in the mountains, for that 10 weeks, he learned enough Spanish and learned how to build homes that he transitioned back to the United States and started going to Indiana Wesleyan University over here. Uh-huh. And he was asked to go overseas on one of their mission trips for the college down to Guatemala to work with Habitat for Humanity. And he said, you're asking me to go down and be a team leader and speak Spanish as a translator? I said, wow. He called me up. He says, I'm going to be a translator on a team. I said, how'd you work that? He says, because of my time in the Dominican Republic. He went down and had such a great trip that they called him back and said, would you come down and work for us next year? So he went down this last summer and worked down in Guatemala for the entire summer serving. And now he's called up and says, you know, I think I'm going to come down and work for you next summer.
Oh,
you know, it was amazing to have lunch with him. He wanted to take me out to lunch with him. He says, I never thought when I came to the Dominican Republic, I came to New Horizons, that God could ever use me. And here I am, after the mess I've been, and I don't let all the kids around this campus know my background, but that God could use me. Do you know what that's done for me in my life? That I have a vision for who I am, and he wants to again go out and continue to serve in a way that's helping other people get hope as well.
Well, Chuck, I thank you. We're just about out of time. Marvin's got a quick comment.
Real quick, Chuck, as a servant, how does that make you feel?
You know, after doing this for 25 years, you just sit back sometimes and you just go, thank you, Lord. Because a lot of people take shots at you and a lot of critics out there, but every once in a while when you get one that just touches your heart, you just sit there silent. Just sit there silent. And I had one like that on the phone the other day where a gal called me up and said, what you told me to do worked. I just want you to know it was a blessing. And I just said, thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord.
Well, Chuck, and thank you. We appreciate so much you coming on. When you get out here, I would love to see you. If we can get you in studio, that would be great as well. Hey, everybody out there, thank you for listening, and God bless.
Thank you, Alan, for having me on your show. I do appreciate it. Thank you, Marvin.
All right, thank you, Chuck.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.